This is an ABC podcast.
And welcome to another week of the Little Wireless program, which starts sadly. As I'm sure you've heard, Laura Tingle has lost her dad and won't be with us tonight. And I know that the listeners will want to join us here at Late Night Live in sending love to lovely Laura, who will be back with us next week in just a moment, Bernard Keane. Then we're going to meet a fellow called Tim Hollow, H-O-L-L-O, who's the director, exec director of something called the Green Institute, and he's written it's an ecological manifesto called Living Democracy, and Tim will be along to explain it shortly. Then someone who's decided to become a farmer, to give up full-time writing, to become a part-time writer and a full-time farmer. His name is San Vincent, and his book is called My Father and Other Animals. But first, Bernard, I want you to join me in a role of theatre critic. I'd like you to take us to the performance today with a spotlight on a certain gentleman and tell me how he performed.
Evening, Philip. Yes, I think John Barilaro gave us an excellent performance today of the distraught and much wronged now former politician, of course, but up until the end of last year, parliamentarian, former deputy premier of New South Wales, and a man who sees himself, I think, as having been wronged in an almost biblical manner by the political gods, perhaps the unluckiest man in New South Wales politics, who, despite winning a lucrative appointment as New York Trade Commissioner on his merits in a completely independent public service appointment process in New South Wales, finds himself now at a loose end, having decided that it was all a bit much.
Bernard, very often during these encounters, the person in the witness stand suffers from amnesia. But Bernard, he hasn't been pretending loss of memory.
No, the phrase, that famous phrase that we know so well from so many hearings over the years, I don't recall, was not invoked very often at all by John Barilaro, and he deserves, I guess, a bit of credit for that. One thing that he couldn't quite recall, though, was how his signature, an electronic signature, but his signature nonetheless, ended up on a document which noted that Jenny West had actually been appointed, or not appointed, but had succeeded in winning the role of New York Trade Commissioner. John Barilaro, then Deputy Premier, was briefed to that effect, but later said he was entirely unaware that Ms. West had been a successful candidate for that role. Couldn't quite explain why his signature was on there. Couldn't really offer much guidance on that. Probably some sort of memory problem there, but otherwise that famous excuse wasn't invoked too often.
How did his co-star go? I know he wasn't on the stand today, but he's there in court in effect, isn't he?
Well, look, the when Stuart Ayres enters the story, John Barilaro's role almost sort of diminishes. It becomes, at that stage, it becomes more about John Barilaro, and rather than featuring or starring him at that point, Stuart Ayres and various other ministers become much more significant in that story, and it becomes one of these sort of tales where the hero is a passive sort of object of various forces around him, rather than an active proponent with his own agency. We didn't really, in the scheme of things, find out a great deal more about this rather sordid spectacle, beyond the fact that John Barilaro made it clear to, seems, every man and his dog in the New South Wales government, that and in every woman for that matter, that he was intending to pursue that New York job, and no one said boo. No one expressed any concern that that might cause a bit of a ruckus.
How is the string puller? How is Perrottet, the puppet master, going in all of this?
Look, I used the word existential in another radio interview this morning, and I know that's the word one shouldn't use too lightly, but I really can't see how Dominic Perrottet gets back into a competitive position after all this. The whole purpose of Perrottet's political presentation since taking over as Premier in New South Wales has been to present himself as a clean skin, as a new generation. New South Wales is under new management and under management with greater integrity, a more moderate, more progressive government. And the last 2 months have just wrecked that image completely with this idea that it's all about jobs for mates. And I think whatever positive things Dominic Perrottet has brought to the role of New South Wales Premier, and I think he has brought a few, particularly in regard to, oddly enough, integrity, it's all going to be for naught, because long way to go to the next election. But I think when New South Wales voters do eventually go to the polls next March, that image of jobs for the mates will have been pretty firmly concreted in their mind after this scandal of the last 2 months.
I don't know what became of Mark Latham, but you will remember his vivid reference to a conga line of suckholes, and I'm thinking about the conga line here because, heavens above, Barry O'Farrell's in it, even Arthur Sinodinos.
Yes, it's an array of liberal luminaries. It's an array of bureaucratic luminaries, for that matter. I'm not sure if that's an oxymoron, but certainly luminaries within the New South Wales Public Service. The thing that I can't get over, Philip, is, and this is what Barilaro confirmed again today, everyone knew he was interested in this role, and yet no politician or political staffer batted an eyelid. The first person to actually say, hang on, does anyone think John Barilaro being appointed to this job is a good idea, was the secretary of the department, Amy Brown. Bureaucrats not employed for their political nous. We spend an awful lot of taxpayer money in New South Wales on political staffers and politicians who are supposed to kind of have some sort of feel for the political zeitgeist. But it took Amy Brown to say, I'm not quite sure this is going to fly. A thought that seemed to escape her political masters. And that for me is going to remain the great mystery throughout all this, is why exactly anyone thought this was a good idea, including John Barilaro himself, of course, who now says, I've got to say somewhat self-pityingly, he wishes he'd never applied in the first place.
Does the apparently inevitable rise of Matt Keane, does that good news for the government?
When you append the term for the government, that's what complicates things. I've got a lot of time for Matt Keane. I think he's the best kind of modern liberal, a man who has a coherent ideology based around both the role of free markets and the role of government. And his recent budget, which was completely blown away in terms of publicity by the Barilaro scandal, was quite outstanding in the way that it more or less shifted the entire economic narrative of New South Wales over the next 20 to 30 years around to female economic participation. Really quite significant change, in unprecedented change in terms of Australian economic thinking. But he's a moderate, and he's from the moderate wing of the party. And, of course, the New South Wales Liberals are enormously good at sabotaging themselves as they go through the ructions caused by this sort of three-way split between the hard right, the moderates, and this centre grouping that was created by Alex Hawke a few years ago. And it's a it's a three-way contest that's fairly incessant within the New South Wales Liberals, and they, as we know, it played a big role in Scott Morrison's difficulties, or the rather New South Wales Liberals' difficulties ahead of the last federal election.
I'd like you to fill the next 3 minutes by doing an abrupt segue to the federal government promising to fund a significant increase to aged care workers' wages.
Now, let's get a little bit of context for this. Now, we've known for decades that aged care workers are underpaid. This is the Aged Care Royal Commission, which was released last year, was only the most recent inquiry that said we really, really need to do something about this. There's been unanimity within the sector that we need to pay aged care workers more. Unanimity in the sense that both employers and unions will say the same thing. And in fact, this is an unusual Fair Work Commission case in which there is virtually no difference. I mean, there's a few bits of difference at the margin, but by and large, unanimity between employers and unions that we need to be paying aged care workers significantly more. It's taken the form of what's called a work value case, where the Fair Work Commission takes a fundamental look at the whole job and says, what is this job worth? How should we be remunerating this? Now, unions have suggested a figure of around 25%, which of course would be an absolutely extraordinary pay rise. As I said, employers don't cavil too much with that sort of figure. They may a bit at the margins, but of course, aged care sector is one of these strange hybrid sectors that we have in Australia, where the role of government in terms of funding is absolutely crucial. So we need someone to fund it. And the big debate during the last election campaign and before that was, would the government commit to funding it? The Morrison government never said it would. The Albanese government has said that it would in its submission to the Fair Work Commission today. It said it would fund whatever it came up with. It did not endorse a figure. I don't think anyone expected that it would endorse a figure, and I don't think we're going to see a 25% increase for aged care workers, but I think it would be certainly in the high teens by the time that the decision is released, probably in the first quarter of next year. These things seem to take an awful long time, and of course we've got a rolling aged care crisis, and we do need a sector that is properly staffed. But like a lot of other sectors in the economy at the moment, Philip, there is a big question mark over where the workers are going to come from, because there are worker shortages right across the economy, particularly in service industries. And if you lift wages in one area, well, that might simply lead to other competing sectors of the economy lifting their wages as well. That'd be a good thing for workers, probably not so good for quality of care in the aged care sector.
The voice of Bernard Keane. Bernard, of course, is political editor for that excellent website, Crikey. Laura will be back with us next week. Bernard, thanks for the contribution you've made to the program in recent weeks. It's been gratefully received and much admired by the Gladys and the Poddies. LNL, RN, one man's positive vision for an ecological democracy. Well, G's and P's, we know the news has been glum for the past couple of years. Black summer, COVID, climate crisis, ecological collapse. But my next guest is here to give us a little bit of hope. Tim Hollow is Executive Director of the Green Institute, and he's the author of a new book called Living Democracy, an Ecological Manifesto for the End of the World as We Know It. And in it, he's putting forward more positive views of how we can embrace both the changes and the challenges. Now, Tim, I understand that you wrote this book initially for your depressed teenager.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Philip. It's fantastic to be here. And certainly, yeah, my young, passionate climate striker was very, very much front of mind for me as I was writing this book, going through a very, very difficult time, as so many young people are at the moment. So, yeah, very much front of mind for me as I was writing this book. So many of these young school strikers, like my teenager, you know, they're looking at the world, they're incredibly well-informed, they're very passionate, they're very committed, they're deeply, deeply distressed, and many of them extremely depressed about the state of the world that they're standing to inherit. And
It's almost like PTSD, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's kind of pre-TSD in a sense. It really is, you know, and they, you know, they're organising tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out onto the streets to actually take action and use their democratic voice. And then they're told by leaders to get back to school, put up and shut up. You know, they're getting a very clear lesson in the abject failure, frankly, of our democratic system to actually properly confront these crises that these kids are deeply well-informed about, more well-informed than most of their political so-called leaders.
Let's look at the book's subtitle. It's Not the End of the World, but the End of the World as We Know It. Please explain. Mm.
Yeah, it's really about kind of saying to people, you know, we can't shy away from the fact that we are in crisis here. We have to confront that. We have to really think about the depth of change which is needed in order to survive and thrive the years ahead. It's very easy for people who are looking, as you said in the introduction, at pandemics, at the climate crisis, at the rise of authoritarianism, at the possibility of war between nuclear-armed superpowers, and think about the end of the world. Well, what I'm doing is looking out around the world and seeing these people and communities all over the place who are actively actually creating and building and cultivating a better way of doing things, a way which is able to confront these crises and help us to survive and thrive. So it's about saying it doesn't have to be the end of the world, but it is already the end of the world as we know it.
Tim, what would ecological politics look like?
Fundamental point is that for me, you know, in conversation with a whole lot of ecological scientists, we need to embrace these ecological ideas of interdependent diversity fundamentally. And so what that means for democracy is that rather than these systems which are built on adversarialism, for instance, and are built on a lot of the time excluding people from the decision-making processes, we need a democratic system which is based on participation and deliberation, which is based on everybody being able to have their voice heard and understood and take part in decision-making in various ways. A lot of this means it's going to be kind of grassroots in local areas, but it can actually work interconnecting those areas to get to quite large-scale government. And there's some amazing examples around the world of governing of areas with millions of people in them based on deep grassroots participatory democracy. And that, to me, is the vision.
It's a sort of decentralised democracy, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's fundamentally about decentralising. So, you know, this vision is that the idea is that centralising is kind of like monoculture in nature, for instance. When you see a monoculture, it's incredibly fragile. Actually, a great big field of the same plants is a remarkably fragile way of doing things. So centralized power, which is, you know, whether it's a large corporation or a large government or whatever it is inherently fragile and problematic, and we need to decentralize this decision-making process.
I hadn't realized that the likes of Bacon, Hobbes and Locke have a villainous role to play in this.
Well, one of the things that I'm writing about in this is that ecology, in ecological ways of thinking, we need to embrace contradiction, actually. We need to embrace the idea that all of us have many aspects to us. And, you know, so I'm writing very much about how Bacon, Hobbes and Locke absolutely contributed to some of the remarkable and important things in our post-Enlightenment world, but they also very, very much, each of them, contributed to the rise of what I think of as an anti-ecological culture, which is a culture which is based on these ideas of separation and domination. And they each in their way contributed very powerfully to that.
Well, Hobbes talked about nature being solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short.
And short.
But I'd forgotten, if I ever knew, that Bacon said nature must be taken by the forelock.
Yes. There's some extraordinary quotes from Bacon, which I include in the book, which demonstrate, you know, it's the thinking of the time. So, you know, I'm not casting blame in any way, but the thinking of the time that he contributed to and helped kind of embed deep in our culture was this idea that ties together patriarchy, colonialism, and the rape of nature very, very much in our political way of thinking.
Okay, I'll allow that Hobbes and Bacon and were men of their time, but what about Tony Abbott, for heaven's sake, who evoked this idea in 2014? He visits Tasmania and says that too much timber is locked up in national parks.
Well, absolutely. This is the thing, is that these ideas are deeply, deeply embedded in our culture. Some people still express them very, quite explicitly. And Tony Abbott's view of the world is one which is, you know, the 19th century dominion narrative idea of Christianity, that God created the heavens and the earth for man to do with as he pleases. It's not the only understanding of Christian doctrine, of course. There's also one of stewardship. But Abbott's view is very, very much this idea that the earth is ours to do with as we please.
It has to be said that it took quite a long time before the churches climbed on the bandwagon. I remember watching Fascinated Horror for years that they weren't particularly interested. Human souls rather than the, if you like, the soul of the planet. Now, you acknowledge this anti-ecological idea also manifested itself under communism, where, of course, we saw a vast environmental destruction.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a crucial point for me, is that, you know, Marx did write about the dangers of what he called metabolic rift, where extraction of resources in one place and putting them somewhere else cause ecological destruction. The rise of state communism was an extraordinarily ecologically destructive one. We certainly saw in the Soviet Union, in China, you know, the destruction of the Aral Sea, you know, black snow. And I think that comes also from this idea of separation from nature and this idea that man, and very much man, can and should dominate nature for our own benefit.
Now, the choice between capitalism and socialism is a false dichotomy. Enter indigenous culture. And indigenous cultures have laws that suppress anti-ecological thinking.
Yeah, this is one of the really important lessons that I came across as I was researching and thinking and reading for this book, is that our society, this anti-ecological view of the world, tells us that this is fundamentally human nature, that we are selfish. This homo economicus idea that we are fundamentally selfish people, and that we have to have a system which embraces that idea of selfishness. Well, actually, for the bulk of human history, we have tended to govern ourselves in ways which understood that we have different natures. We have a selfish nature. We also have a deeply altruistic and cooperative nature. And we can build systems of governing ourselves which bring out the best in us and suppress the worst. And pretty much every indigenous culture that we know of had these extraordinary ways, laws, cultures, systems, which were about suppressing those darker instincts in us, suppressing competition, suppressing our ego, and working out ways to ensure that we cooperate with each other for common benefit and for the benefit of the natural world, which we understood ourselves to be part of.
A new report that there's typically three laws of respect. Respect and honour the self, respect and honour everyone else, respect and honour our mother, the earth.
That's right. It's so crucially important, and this absolute flip for many of us who've been brought up in the anti-ecological way of thinking that humans can own and control and seek to determine the future of land and country that we live on. The indigenous understanding is deeply that country owns us and we are entirely dependent on it. So all of our laws and everything that is about human interaction between us is fundamentally reliant on the health of the natural world, which is what we come from and what we return to. So it's deeply embedded in this idea that if we don't have a healthy country, we don't have healthy humans.
Now, I promised the listener in this era of woes and wars that there's some hope. And so I now want you to take me to a place known as the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria.
This is one of the most exciting things around, in my opinion. It's also known as Rojava. You're probably, and your listeners, I'm sure many of them are aware of the plight of the Kurdish people over a very long time, that post-imperialism, the Middle East was split up into a whole set of countries with clear borders, and the Kurds didn't get a country. The Kurds ended up living across Turkey and Syria and Iraq. And for a very long time, they were fighting what was very much explicitly a Maoist revolutionary battle. And they were losing. They were losing badly. And then one of their leaders, Abdullah Öcalan, came across the writings of Murray Bookchin, who was an American anarchist thinker. And he wrote back to them from where he was in a Turkish prison and said, rather than fighting for our own state, why don't we just start building our own nation ourselves? And they started to do it. They created this grassroots-up way of governing their own societies in the wreckage around them, suburb by suburb, block by block, working out how to manage their own lives. And they now have government of 2 million people, a multi-ethnic, gender-balanced, very, very ecologically sensitive nation that they're building there in northern East Syria.
The people organise their own rubbish collection, they fix their own water supplies, develop school curricula, settle their own disputes and clean up after the bombs drop.
It's really an amazingly hopeful picture what they're building there. Amidst some of the most repressive regimes on the planet, one of their fundamental principles is gender equity. So each of these local groups, which is about participatory democracy in their own blocks, is convened by a pair of people, one of whom must be a woman. So they're very, very clear about that. In that deep culture, they're about actually caring for the land which they live on, which has been so badly affected by generations of terrible governance. It's an extraordinary picture of hope, of a different way of doing government.
And something similar is happening in Western cities with the formation of more co-ops and things called B corporations, which I've heard Elizabeth Warren talk about. Tell me about B corporations.
So B corporations are one of the many models now of different ways of doing corporations, whether it be cooperative governance or a whole range of different models. The fundamental point about B corporations is that rather than a corporation which is designed purely around profit and distributing profit to owners and shareholders, B corporations are about embedding into the governance requirements of the organisation that it takes into account social and environmental consequences as well, all the way through supply chains, all the way through the activities that the company undertakes. So it's a really creative and interesting model for how to do business differently as well.
Now, here's another model, fund theory. Tell me about fund theory. People... participating in democracy, having fun.
This is really, really important. You know, one of the successes, I think, of the destructive anti-ecological model is that it turns us off democracy. It turns us off politics. It's amazing how often when you try to talk to people about politics, they kind of grimace all the time because our politics is ugly. It is unpleasant. But when you get people around a kitchen table and start to have conversations about better ways of doing things, when you get people in a food co-op where they're working out how to do things better, when you get people organising a walking school bus or doing something with a PNC, so often it's filled with joy. And so many people have seen this recently with the rise of mutual aid, for instance, in response to the pandemic. People coming together in their community, letterboxing their neighbourhoods, calling each other, making sure they're okay, touching in with people and helping, offering help to collect medicines from the chemist or groceries or whatever. There's so much joy in these processes of doing politics and doing democracy differently and better with participation. And that's something that we really need to reclaim.
So much to cover, so little time. Briefly, panarchy as opposed to anarchy.
Panarchy is a model that was developed by a group of ecological scientists in the late 20th century who had spent their careers looking at very specific ecosystems and decided to step back and think about what kind of model there is for change. And panarchy looks at how every system in ecology, from the cell all the way up to grand continent-spanning ecosystems, goes through the same process of growth, conservation, collapse, and regrowth. And out of collapse comes the space for regrowth of something new. And it's a model of change which actually applies to human society as well as to our bodies and to each of the individual cells within it. And to me, this is part of where it comes to with this idea of this is the end of the world as we know it. We are clearly at a point of collapse. I think most of us recognise that we are. The question we need to ask and that we need to try to inform is, what is it that's collapsing? And what is it that's actually growing? And we can determine that. We can help to determine which parts of our society and economy collapse and which parts that we can regrow. And that will determine what comes next.
What's your response in a couple of words to the recent release of the State of the Environment report by Bilbasek?
I think it's very clear, one of the words that they used in that was collapse. This is one of the starkest warnings that we've seen in this country from a body like that ever, that we are on the cusp of really deep ecological collapse. And if we allow that to happen, then we are in very deep, deep trouble. But from that process of actually putting that on the table and putting it out there comes an extraordinary opportunity for us to think deeply about it.
Got to go, Tim. Thank you very much. Tim Hollow, author of Living Democracy, an Ecological Manifesto for the End of the World as We Know It, published by New South Books. And coming up, what happens when a new generation takes over the family farm? A few years ago, we had Charles Massey on the program talking about his book on regenerative farming, Call of the Reed Warbler. David and Jane Vincent were some of the farmers who featured in the book, and it was on their farm that Charles heard the reed warbler warbling, which of course featured in the book's title. Now their son, Sam Vincent, has taken over the farm and is continuing to refine the holistic and regenerative principles that were established by his parents. Now, we've had Sam on the program before talking about his first book, which was a very different topic, the whaling industry. His career as a full-time farmer is caught him by surprise, but he's still trying to balance the farming life with his writing, including his latest book about his transition to life on the farm. The book is called My Father and Other Animals. It's published by Black Ink. Welcome back, Sam. It's been a while, and I understand you're standing in a very cold, windswept paddock so you can get a fugitive phone signal.
I am, and I wasn't sure how close I should get to the frogs. They're pretty deafening down the bottom of the valley. But if I stand between these two wattle trees, I think the signal will work for us.
Mate, you're very lucky to have frogs because, you know, they've largely disappeared from the landscape and the soundscape of Australia. Now, when we last spoke, you were talking about the need to end the whaling industry. How did you go from being an environmental activist to being a farmer? Although, of course, as you will demonstrate, you can be both.
Yeah, I was living in Canberra, plodding along as a freelance journalist and doing some research assistant work at ANU when I got a phone call from my mother saying that my dad had stuck his hand in a wood chipper and he'd kept his hand, but it kind of prompted an urgent discussion about what we should do with the future of the farm. And as the only one of my siblings who lived nearby, I came out and we had a meeting and it was decided that I would start working with him a couple of days a week.
Now, you've got three sisters, they're not siblings, they're sisters, and they didn't want to pick up the slack.
No, they all left the farm to go to uni interstate. And I never really thought about picking up the slack either. And initially it was just a way of keeping my dad out of harm's way, stopping him from more mishaps. He can be a bit reckless.
Now, tell us about your farm. It's 650 acres and it's quite close to Canberra.
Yeah, it's only 3 kilometres from the ACT border. It's a long and skinny farm. It's very hilly. My parents established an orchard of 70 different fruit trees when we were growing up to be self-sufficient in fruit, and they had sheep initially and then switched to Angus cattle about 20 years ago. And gradually, Dad moved away from conventional farming and adopted regenerative principles and dropped his inputs and stopped using synthetic fertilizer and started making compost tea and fixing up the creek that you mentioned in the introduction.
I think you should also introduce the notion of figs. Tell us about you, the farm, and figs.
So when I started working with Dad, and I did start getting interested in what he was doing, but we wanted to find a project that would be mine to start on the farm. And in the top orchard, this old 40-year-old orchard, there's one tree that is magnificent. It stands above all the others. Nothing ever attacks it. It produces beautiful figs from about late February to well into May. And we'd sold a few to restaurants and bakeries in Canberra, and everyone loved it. So I thought it would be a good idea to get cuttings off this tree and establish an orchard just of black Genoa figs that were genetically identical to this mother tree.
You're lucky that they survived. We lost our figs in the drought, and including some really, really ancient and one thought pretty well immortal examples. Mm. Now, let's walk this back a little, because the incident where your father put his hand in the chipper hangs over us. So you started off with a temporary arrangement of you working part-time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was very subtle. We never really discussed me taking over or me becoming a farmer. It just became a kind of unspoken understanding, I guess. Maybe my dad saw that I was growing interested and enjoying spending time with him and learning things like fencing and working with cattle and the fruit. And then I remember one day we were talking about a neighbour's place and he said, oh, he'll probably buy you out one day. So it was a bit of a go at me, but I also thought, oh, so that's an assumption that I'll be living here and farming here. And I think I do want to do that. It took a few years before it became an apprenticeship of sorts, and it lasted about 7 years all up before I took over just when the drought broke in 2020.
Now, you've got a new baby, I understand.
Yeah, baby Orlando was born in the midst of fig season and just after I'd submitted the book. So it was a crazy, crazy few weeks and months after that.
And does your partner share your enthusiasm for farming, Sam?
No, she's from Sydney. She's a writer as well and a former broadcaster, Lauren Carol Harris. But she's an amazing cook and she loves working with all the stuff that I can bring in from the paddock and orchards. We really like the idea of being as self-sufficient as possible. And so most of our meat, I slaughter myself and just about all the fruit we eat comes from the orchards. And increasingly the veggie garden is providing us with what we need.
It's a marvellous sense, isn't it? A feeling being self-sustaining like that.
Yeah, and Australia doesn't have a great tradition of that compared to countries like France and Italy. I think I read a stat that in the 60s, only about 1% of the food that Australian farmers ate was from their properties. That we've kind of gone down the American route of conventional big agriculture. So it's nice to try and reverse that a bit.
Now, both of us raise cattle, although we got pretty much out of it because of the monumental drought. Destocking wasn't enough. But we have some problems here, don't we? Because cattle are an issue.
We do, and it's always hard to bring this up because undoubtedly cattle are an issue. Globally, a lot of beef production is horrible for the environment, whether it's Amazon deforestation in Brazil or factory farming in America. But the kind of grazing I do is holistic planned grazing of the kind that tries to mimic how herd and predator ecosystems work. So bunching the cattle up together in small paddocks and letting them intensively graze for a few days and then moving them on to another paddock so that the pastures left behind have here upwards a year to recover. And this can help sequester carbon and we've seen an increase in biodiversity, a lot of perennial native species coming back. I'm trying to walk this line between bringing back native species and also producing food from the invasive cow.
Well, one of the naughty things cows do notoriously is they burp. Let's discuss burps.
Yeah, so methane obviously is nothing new. There have been hundreds of millions of ruminants walking around the earth before the Industrial Revolution when we started burning so much coal and laid the foundation for the current climate crisis. So what I would argue is that, yeah, of course it would be great if cattle didn't burp so much, but if used in a judicious way on grasslands and appropriate environments, rangelands like the one I live on, then they can help sequester more carbon than methane that they emit. And
they can also, despite rumours to the contrary, be quite good to the land, to the earth itself.
Yeah, I think there's this persistent idea that Australia is incompatible with cloven animals, hooved animals. And I think the more I work with cattle and see their effect on the land here, I think that's more about the management of them. Just the other day I was pulling a calf out of a fence on the neighbour's place and I marvelled at this erosion patch I'd never noticed that began right on the other side of the fence. So our farm was fine and there was no bare ground to be seen. Then this huge gully just appeared at the boundary fence. And I don't think it was a coincidence that this neighbour has sheep in that one paddock all year round.
Overgrazing is one of the most destructive bad habits of shoddy farming.
Absolutely. And the farm that I now live on and work on was completely clapped out and overgrazed when my parents moved here. So we've really been trying over the decades to return a bit of topsoil to the land.
Now, we have to make the point that people like you and I, farmers who like to think they're on the right side of history, we're not monolithic in our views. We have our arguments and our disagreements and not all of us have the same heroes. But where do you fit with Alan Savory?
Yeah, I went to TAFE to learn about holistic management and Alan Savory's the founder of that and a godlike figure to a lot of graziers. I don't buy completely his argument that cattle alone can fix the climate crisis. I think that's unfounded and a bit ambitious. But from personal experience, seeing how this farm was when my parents were set stocking with sheep, and now how it's changed with rotationally grazed cattle, I think there's definitely something to his claims that you can both make money, produce food, and increase biodiversity, and the ability of the landscape to hold water, improve your soil microbiology. So yeah, I'm generally a fan of Alan Savory.
What about a farm that gets less rainfall? Can it generate enough grass to feed a herd of cattle using the model?
Well, I was pretty frustrated during the drought. There was so much talk from the National Party, particularly about the need to dig more dams, when this is not an effective way of storing water in the landscape. So in an increasingly unpredictable climate, I'm trying to farm in a way that doesn't rely on that much rainfall. If I can trap as much as I can by having little or no bare ground on the farm so that it soaks in and can be stored in the soil so it's not evaporating and can help perennial grasses grow, then that'll help with diminishing rainfall.
We've also gotten back to encouraging, as far as we can, native grasses.
Yeah, and we're finding that they are appearing naturally through these long rest periods. It's been such a lovely time to farm here since the drought broke. We've had three incredibly wet years. And so my rest period is around a year. So that means that the cattle aren't getting back to the same paddock they grazed for upwards.
Because you have to prevent animals from eating a plant that is not sufficiently recovered.
Exactly. It's called the law of the second bite.
Say that again.
The law of the second bite. The idea is that if a cow chomps a blade of grass, that blade of grass, that plant will have to rely on the energy in its roots because it won't be able to photosynthesize as well without this leaf that's been eaten. And so you have to let it recover. If you let the cow chomp it again before it's had a chance to grow back, then it'll die and create bare ground, the soil will blow away, and we'll see what we've largely seen in the grazing industry over the last couple of centuries.
I'm talking to Sam Vincent, who's standing in a paddock in close proximity to frogs. Sam, my wife, Patrice, is an Indigenous Australian, a First Nations Australian, and we've been coming increasingly to terms with the reality that we're effectively farming on stolen land. How have you coped with that knowledge?
Well, soon after I started working with my dad, a friend of mine, Dave Johnston, who's a legendary Indigenous archaeologist based at the ANU, he asked me if he could come out to the farm just to look around. And I really wanted him to. I wanted to learn more about the history of this farm hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of years ago. We spent a few weeks walking around. It was during an earlier drought, which archaeologists love, I learned, because it's easier to find things. And in about the third week, he found an ochre quarry. It was a hill that my family always called Bald Hill. It was a strange outcrop, and it has bright, bright yellow soil. And Dave brought out some archaeologist mates, and they found some tools, one of which was a 5,000-year-old stone tool used to gouge ochre out of the rocks. And ochre would have been used by the Ngambri and Ngunnawal communities for all kinds of things, for birthing ceremonies and weddings and funerals. And so on Dave's encouragement, we engaged with local Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal and Ngambri elders, and they all came out and they're all really interested in this site. And we, over a few years, we organised to have it protected by the New South Wales government, and it was gazetted in 2018 as an Aboriginal place. And it's now called Derowa Dowra, which is a Ngunnawal word meaning yellow ground. I think it's the highlight of my farming career so far. It's really enriched my understanding of what is now the farm, but for tens of thousands of years was important to other people for other reasons.
I think you also found some trees with Aboriginal markings.
We did. There's a beautiful scar tree on our boundary. In fact, it probably was a boundary. There's a dog leg in the fence that skirts around this old scar tree, which is hundreds of years old. And when we were walking around looking for artifacts, Dave asked us to ask this neighbour if we could jump the fence and have a look on her property. And she was really resistant. She said she didn't want any Aboriginal people on her land. And I think it really cut to the hostility that a lot of white farmers have towards even learning about the Indigenous history of what is now their land. There's this misguided belief that if they find anything, then their land will be taken, which kind of shows the lack of understanding of how Native Title works in this country, but also that I believe the deep shame and sorrow that exists among farmers who know that they're on stolen land. They just don't always admit it.
Have there been any issues around you taking over the farm with your three sisters?
Not really. They're largely supportive. They all have careers in the cities, and none of them, apart from my sister Eve, has a strong attachment to the land. But I'm pretty sanguine about this. I think that family comes first, and I'm not inheriting the farm. I'm managing it for my family. I bought the cattle herd off my parents, and I'm slowly building it back up after the drought, and I've established this fig orchard. But if one of us wants to sell our share in the future, then we'll cross that bridge and work that out.
I have to ask you this. Have you heard the reed warbler warbling lately?
Maybe. I'm not a twitcher like Charles Massey, so I actually don't know when I'm out there if I'm hearing or seeing the reed warbler. But the creek is looking pretty good, and it's quite noisy out there, so I suspect I have.
And you're also hearing plenty of frogs.
I am. It was amazing when the drought broke here. I still remember the day, the 20th of February 2020. And that night I was walking around these suddenly sodden paddocks and there were frogs everywhere. I could hear them. I thought it was remarkable. I don't know where they came from. They just appeared.
I'll let you in on a secret. Sometimes the sky rains frogs.
And fish sometimes,
and
too.
Fish. People mock and scoff, but you and I know it's true. Sam, thanks for coming on. Sam Vincent, Walkley Award-winning journo, now a farmer and still an author. The book we've been discussing is called My Father and Other Animals, How I Took on the Family Farm, and it's published by Black Ink. Coming up, a Shapiroette with Bruce, and then we're going to find out about the network of mates that is contributing to Australia's growing inequality. And we'll hear a defence of what's called disfluency with Jonty Claypool. In other words, why our obsession with fluency may be hindering our creativity. Don't miss it.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.